the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Novak. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, we will hear from Brian Lynn and Gregory Stockel. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a patient in the United States with the disease leukemia has become the first woman to be cured of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. The patient received stem cells from a donor. Stem cells are special cells that can become any kind of cell in the body. The donor was naturally resistant to HIV, researchers told reporters Tuesday. The woman has been described as a 64-year-old woman of mixed race. Her case was presented at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections in Denver, Colorado. It is the first case involving the use of blood from the umbilical cord. The umbilical cord connects a pregnant mother to her fetus. Use of umbilical blood is a somewhat new method. Doctors are considering making the treatment available to more people. The woman had been receiving the umbilical cord blood to treat her leukemia. Leukemia is a cancer that starts in blood-forming cells in bones. Since receiving the treatment, the woman has been in remission. She has been free of HIV for 14 months. She has not needed HIV treatments known as antiretroviral therapy. The two earlier cases in which patients were cured happened in males who had received adult stem cells. Adult stem cells are often used in bone marrow transplants. This is now the third report of a cure in this setting, and the first in a woman living with HIV, said Sharon Lewin in a statement. She is soon to be the head of the International AIDS Society. The woman's case is part of a larger study led by Dr. Yvonne Bryson of the University of California, Los Angeles, and Dr. Deborah Persaud of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. It is being financially supported by the U.S. government. The study aims to follow 25 people with HIV who receive a transplant with stem cells taken from umbilical cord blood for the treatment of cancer and other serious conditions. Patients in the study first receive treatment to destroy cancerous cells. Doctors then transplant stem cells from individuals with a genetic mutation which makes them resistant to HIV. Scientists believe the patients receiving the transplant will develop an immune system resistant to HIV. Lewin said bone marrow transplants do not cure most people living with HIV. But she said the report confirms that a cure for HIV is possible and further strengthens using gene therapy as an effective way to cure HIV. The study suggests that an important part of the treatment's success was using HIV-resistant cells. Taken together, these three cases of a cure post-stem cell transplant all help in discovering the parts of the transplant that were important to a cure, Lewin said.
The state of Texas is suing Facebook's parent company Meta over its collection of facial recognition data. The lawsuit, filed on February 14th, accuses the social media company of illegally capturing biometric information from pictures and videos of users. Biometric systems are designed to collect biological data that is unique to each person in order to identify individuals. Facial recognition is one kind of biometric method. Such systems use similar methods to those used in fingerprinting technology. The lawsuit says that Facebook collected the biometric data for business purposes. It also accused the company of sharing the information with third parties and failing to destroy the information within a reasonable amount of time. Attorney General Ken Paxton took the case to a state court in Marshall, Texas. He said in a statement, "This is yet another example of big tech's deceitful business practices, and it must stop. I will continue to fight for Texans' privacy and security." The lawsuit states that Meta's collection operation had stored millions of biometric identifiers. These include information related to eye scans, voice recordings, and hand and face features. The data came from photos and video users uploaded to Meta's social media services, including Facebook and Instagram. Paxton said the collection process had used people and their children with the intent to turn a profit at the expense of one's safety and well-being. Under Texas law, companies are barred from gathering or using biometric data of an individual unless they have received that individual's permission to do so. State law also bars companies from sharing such data with others. A few exceptions to the rule include law enforcement. The Wall Street Journal reported that a person with knowledge of the lawsuit told the newspaper Texas was seeking hundreds of billions of dollars in damages. In 2020, Meta agreed to pay $650 million to settle a state lawsuit in Illinois that dealt with similar issues. In a statement, Meta promised to fight the accusations and said the lawsuit was without merit. In November, the company announced it was ending its facial recognition system. The system was designed to identify users based on physical features in photos and videos. At the time, a Meta official said the company still saw facial recognition technology as a powerful tool. But the official noted that the situations where it can be helpful need to be weighed against growing concerns about this technology as a whole. Last week, Meta settled a 10-year-old lawsuit related to another privacy issue. The company agreed to pay $90 million to a group of users who accused it of following their internet activity even after they had signed out of the Facebook social media service. As part of that lawsuit, Meta agreed to remove all the data it had wrongfully collected during 2010 and 2011. While the company denied wrongdoing, it agreed to settle the case to avoid the costs and risks of a trial. Settlement papers showed. I'm Brian Lynn. A new government report says sea levels on the U.S. coastline are expected to rise by at least 0.25 meters in the next 30 years. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and six other federal agencies created the report. It predicts that the sea level along the U.S. coast will be 0.25 to 0.3 meters higher by 2050. The report warns of more floods from storms and high water levels on the coast, even on sunny days during high tides. Make no mistake, sea level rise is upon us, said Nicole LaBeouf, director of NOAA's National Ocean Service. LaBeouf warned that the cost will be high. She said the United States coasts are home to a lot of economic activity and 40% of the U.S. population. William Sweet was the report's lead writer. He said that the largest sea level rise from melting of ice in Antarctica and Greenland probably will not start until after 2100. Sea levels can rise more in some places than others because land can sink. Also, currents and water from melting ice are different from place to place. The report predicts sea levels in the U.S. will rise more than the world average. Sweet said the greatest rise in the U.S. will be on the Gulf of Mexico and East Coast. The West Coast and Hawaii will be below the average. The report predicts 0.6 meters of sea level rise in St. Petersburg, Florida, a city on the Gulf of Mexico. But the study predicts just 0.36 meters in Los Angeles, California. Cities like Miami Beach, Florida, Annapolis, Maryland, and Norfolk, Virginia already get a few minor floods every year during high tides. The researchers said those will be replaced by several moderate floods by about 2050. Those floods will cause property damage. It's going to be areas that haven't been flooding that are starting to flood, Sweet said. He added, many of our major metropolitan areas on the East Coast are going to be increasingly at risk. The report said the western coast of the Gulf of Mexico should have the biggest sea level rise by 2050. The researchers predict a sea level rise of 0.4 to 0.45 meters. The eastern Gulf of Mexico should expect 0.35 to 0.4 meters of sea level rise by 2050. The southeast U.S. coast should get 0.3 to 0.35 meters of sea level rise, and the northeast U.S. coast should get 0.25
to 0.3 meters of sea level rise. The report is estimating an average of about 0.6 meters of sea level rise in the United States as a whole by 2100. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The stock market crash of 1929 began a long and difficult period for the United States. President Herbert Hoover struggled to find solutions as the nation sank into the worst economic crisis in its history. But the Great Depression was not the only problem demanding answers from Hoover. The president also had to deal with a number of foreign policy issues. I'm Mario Ritter. With Chris Cruz, we look at how the Great Depression affected relations between the United States and other countries.
My mother told me before she passed away, said, son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray, 'cause there'll be hard times, hard times, oh yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I?
There were revolutions in South America. Japan launched a campaign of aggression in northeastern China, and the economic situation in America created serious problems in relations with Europe. Hoover succeeded in some areas of his foreign policy, but he failed to solve America's economic troubles. And, like most Americans, he failed to recognize the importance of political changes taking place in Japan and Germany.
Herbert Hoover's foreign policy was marked by his desire to make friends and avoid war. Like most Americans, the new president had been shocked by World War I. Hoover had seen the results of that terrible war with his own eyes. He led the international effort to feed the many European victims of the fighting. The new president was also a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends. Quakers oppose war. Hoover shared the wish of most Americans that the world would never again fight a major war. To him, the bloody bodies at Verdun, the Marne, and the other battlefields of World War I showed the need to seek peace through negotiations.
Hoover worked toward this goal even before he entered the White House. Following his election, he had several months before becoming president. Hoover used this time to travel to Latin America for 10 weeks. He wanted to show Latin American nations that they could trust the United States to honor their rights as independent nations. Hoover kept his word. The year after he took office, his administration announced that it would recognize the governments of all Latin American countries, including governments that the United States did not like. Hoover told the American people that he would not follow the Latin American policies of President Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt decided in 1904 that the United States had a right to intervene in Latin America if it disagreed with the actions of governments there. Hoover said this was wrong. He told the country that it was more important to use friendship than to use force.
Hoover withdrew American forces from Nicaragua. He also arranged to withdraw them from Haiti. And he showed restraint as some 50 revolutions shook the nations of Latin America. Some revolutionary governments opposed the United States. They refused to pay debts to American companies, or they claimed ownership of foreign property. But Hoover refused to advance American interests by force. He wanted to prove that the United States could treat Latin American nations as equals. That policy was quite successful. Relations between the United States and Latin American countries generally improved under Herbert Hoover's leadership.
The situation in Europe was much more difficult and much more serious for the United States. The problem was simple: money. The Great Depression did not stop at America's borders. It moved to Britain, Europe, and beyond. And it brought extremely hard economic conditions. In Germany, the value of the national currency collapsed. Inflation forced people to buy goods with hundreds, thousands, even millions of German marks. They lost faith in the system, and they looked for some new leader to provide solutions. The economic crisis also put great pressure on the international circle of debt that had been created after the war. Suddenly, American bankers could no longer make loans to Germany. This meant that Germany could not pay back war debts to France and the other Allied nations in the war to end all wars. And without this money, the Allied nations could not repay money that they owed American banks. The circle of debt fell apart.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The situation grew worse and worse throughout the early months of 1930. Hoover finally had to announce that all nations could delay their debt payments to the United States for 1 year. Hoover's actions did what he wanted it to. It put a temporary stop to the international debt crisis. But it caused great damage to private banks. People lost faith in the banking system. Throughout Europe, people withdrew their money from banks. As a result, the European banks could not repay more than $1 billion that they had borrowed from private American banks.
This was not the only problem. Nations throughout Europe were also forced to take their currencies off the gold standard. This meant their money no longer could be exchanged for gold. The economic situation grew worse, and as it did, serious political tensions began to threaten peace in Asia and Europe.
The threat in Asia became clear first. Japan had defeated Russia in a war in 1905. This victory gave Japan control over the economy of the southern part of what was then called Manchuria in northeastern China. As years passed, Japan began to feel threatened by two forces. First, Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek was trying to organize all of China under the control of his nationalist forces. Second, Russia was extending the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Japan's army took control of the government in Tokyo in late 1931. The army was fearful of the growing threat to Japan's control of Manchuria, so it moved Japanese troops immediately into several Manchurian cities, and it claimed political control of the whole area. President Hoover and most Americans strongly opposed Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to take any action that might lead to another world war.
Japan's military leaders knew that the people of Europe and America had no desire to fight to protect China. And so the Japanese army marched on. It invaded the huge city of Shanghai, killing thousands of civilians. Western leaders condemned the action. American Secretary of State Henry Stimson said the United States would not recognize Japanese control in these areas of China. But again, Hoover refused to consider any economic actions against the Japanese, and he strongly opposed taking any military action. The League of Nations also refused to recognize Japan's takeover. It called Japan the aggressor in Manchuria. Japan reacted simply. It withdrew from the League of Nations.
Most Americans were not happy about Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to fight force with force. This was less true, however, for Secretary of State Stimson. Stimson was a follower of the old ideas of President Theodore Roosevelt. He believed a nation could only have a strong foreign policy by being strong and using its military power in times of crisis. But Stimson's voice was in the minority. Most Americans did not believe Japan really threatened the security of the United States, and they were not ready to risk their lives to help people in China. Opinions changed only after Japanese planes attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, in December of 1941.
The same story was true in Europe, but France was worried about the rising power of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy and Spain. France proposed the creation of an international army. Hoover opposed that idea. He called for all nations to reduce their weapons. He believed that negotiation, not force, was the way to solve the problem. But the new leaders in Germany and Japan would listen much more closely to the footsteps of marching troops than to the high words of peace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Dan Novak.